Okay, this is continuing with Derek Vonberg on 21 May 1981. Now, can you remember exactly when you did begin?
Well, I can't. I think it was, I'm looking at the records of what I said back in the last interview, and as far as I can remember, it was mid-1945.
Okay, so just immediately after the war ended.
The Japanese war was still in progress.
Right. But now, you were assigned more or less to Ryle's group, and then what was the first task at hand that you remember?
Well, we had to decide what particular line of research we would do.
Right.
Ryle, of course, was very interested, and Ratcliffe was very interested. Ratcliffe's an ionospheric research man, as you know.
Right.
And Ryle and Ratcliffe were talking about using the rockets which the Germans had perfected,
right,
in order to study the upper atmosphere,
right,
somewhere or other. And I can remember a great deal of pacing up and down in Ryle's office while he churned over the possibilities of using these rockets. I think he didn't like the idea because Ryle was a very independent and highly original person, and the idea of being dependent on rockets being sent up by someone else, because he obviously would not be in a position to carry the whole responsibility,
right,
didn't appeal to him too much.
You mean it would get involved with committees and...
It would be out of his control.
Right, I see.
That's my opinion of why he didn't like it. But I'm sure he was also weighing up the possible future developments that might come out of this. And I think he was rather looking for something really new and to get away from the old ionospheric studies.
Right.
Really. I can't tell you exactly how it arose, or who suggested it, but there then arose during these discussions, which were really Ryle's thinking aloud. I made practically no... I just marveled at the way this chap's mind was working around, and he would just comment on his thoughts, and I just sat there and absorbed them.
Right, right.
And he was beginning to think about this radio noise, and I think that Ratcliffe was probably also playing a part in this, because I can remember an interesting development there that... Ratcliffe was very interested in getting something actually done. Ryle had enormous confidence in his ability to analyze situations away from the equipment.
Right.
And he wanted to really think right through the problem of this, the possibilities of radio noise.
Yes.
And measurements outside the Earth. Originating outside the Earth, he would plan to build a proper, really absolute measuring equipment to do the job precisely in a predictable manner.
Right.
Whereas Ratcliffe's approach was much more, I don't know how you call it, pragmatic, or he said, well, look, the thing to do is to get some measurements done. And,
right.
And, actually see something, and Ryle was had quite a different approach to this.
Yeah, well, these two styles, one can still see in science, of course, in different people.
Yeah.
This must have created some tension between them, didn't it?
Well, I think a bit, yes.
Yeah.
And I can remember, I don't know if you want me to go on like this.
Yes, this is just the kind of stuff I like, yes.
There was one particular, I was always trying to, be helpful around the place and take an optimistic view of things. And Ryle was a little bit depressive, and Ratcliffe was always urging something to happen, and he got hold of, persuaded Ryle to get hold of, some field radar set. I can't even tell you what wavelength it was working on, but it can't be very great, because it was a little sort of thing which you set up in a tent sort of thing.
Right.
And he got hold of one of these, because there were a lot of spare equipment knocking around from captured from the Germans,
right,
and so forth, and a surplus a bit from our sources. Anyhow, he managed to persuade Ryle, or got himself got hold of one of these sets, and said, well, you get it out into the field. field and set it up and see if you can't see something, you see. Mm-hmm. There's some noise, point at the sun, anything you like, you see. Look at the Milky Way. Get some measurements going. And Ratcliffe and Riles sort of was sort of digging his heels in all the time and saying, no, this isn't the way to do it. What we should do is to do all the calculations, work out every aspect of what you're going to do, make sure you've got a set which is the right sensitivity, calibrate everything, so when you do get a measurement, it means something,
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Right.
Well, anyhow, so Ratcliffe kept pushing, and finally we ended up with me rushing around in the field with this wretched bit of radar and pointing it around the place, and Ryle being thoroughly annoyed and disinterested in the whole process. And finally, of course, we saw nothing, or if we did, we didn't know what it was.
So right.
Ryle said, right, well, that's the end of that one. We'll now get down and do the job properly.
Right,
so
right.
He settled down and designed this noise generator device, and he set up the laboratory and the standing wave measurements, and which he was very familiar with, having designed aerials and transmitter systems for radar during the war.
Right.
And he knew what his noise factors were in his receivers, and he knew exactly, and he got his diodes, absolute noise generators sorted out, and an automatic feedback system so that you knew exactly from the diode current what actual level of noise you were, and he calibrated in terms of degrees of black body radiation.
Right.
And then some months later, we then started to set up an aerial system with these bedsteads and all the rest of it, sets of dipoles, arrays of dipoles, to start looking at the real signals in a little hut behind the house where we were all living out in Herschel Road.
In Herschel Road, right. This
Herschel
is before
Road is where he lives, and we shared the house.
Right. Now, this is different from the Grange Road site or adjacent to it?
Grange Road.
The Grange Road site is the one that was used up until the...
Yeah, that's right. It was Herschel Road turning off Grange Road.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So it's the beginning of the Grange Road.
Right, and it's right behind Ryle's house, and he still lives in that house,
that's
yeah.
Right. The eastern end was limited by the football field.
Exactly, right.
But by an incredible stroke of luck, which always seemed to characterize everything that Ryle did, it was a long stretch running east-west.
Right.
It was made for doing interference measurements,
with a transit instrument, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So we could stretch out, and we got our initial measurements. He began to get signals from the Milky Way, very broad system, and no sign. I don't think we saw very much in the way of small sources there.
No, not that early, I don't think, no.
And then we had this, somehow the idea came of having a look at the sun.
Mm-hmm.
There was one very amusing, very early incident there, because we had got the receivers quite nicely working by then, and reasonably well calibrated, and noise signal generators available and so forth, or most of them homemade. But we really knew by then what the equipment was doing, and we could calibrate it in terms of actual temperature.
Right.
It didn't really mean temperature, but in the equivalent.
Well, we call an antenna temperature now, right?
Yeah. Well, now, one hot afternoon, somewhere near the sunspot spot maximum, we were sitting there in this hut, and we had rigged up a couple of aerials outside, separated by, I can't tell you how far, but some distance apart, with an rigged up as an interference system.
Right.
And we were waiting there to see whether... obviously, the great thing was to find out how small the source was,
mm-hmm.
whether it was larger than the sun or smaller than the sun or how small.
Right.
So we set this system up, and it would be able to tell you whether the source was smaller than the sun, you see.
Right.
And there was great excitement, Ryle and I, up there, because we were looking for the first signs of a move of the pen. We had these Everett Edgecombe pen recorders.
Right.
And we were looking for a sinusoidal movement across the
right,
which would show that we had a source coming into view. And we waited around, and the sun should by now have been getting into the aerial lobes, because they were not very directional.
Mm-hmm.
When rather suddenly the pen started to move across the paper, and it moved right across, you see, and then when it got to the top, it moved all the way back again.
Yes.
And we thought, heck, what are we onto now, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And this thing went flying up and down, you know, absolutely. Well, it was just incredible.
Were you quite convinced that it was from the sun?
No. You know, we it was all very puzzling. But and then rather suddenly, at about 4 o'clock, or maybe a bit earlier, it stopped dead. You see, and we looked at each other, and then Ryle, sort of a smile came across his face, and he said, "Have you noticed anything?" Of course, I hadn't noticed anything. He said, "Well, the chap stopped mowing on the field next door."
Ah, yes.
However, we went on, of course, to get more sensitive receivers, better aerials, and well separated, and then up came the sun signals, and we had great excitement because, of course, we were steadily ferrying back rather nice big cables from the German radar system.
Yes.
Which we uncoil, they were sending about an inch and a half diameter, I think, quite low loss affair.
I have a nice picture about 1949 era with Graham Smith working with these things.
Yes.
Did you call them jerry cables in your day also?
Pardon?
Did you call them jerry cables?
That's right, yes. That's
yes,
right. Jerry
right.
was the common name for the Germans.
Right.
And we rolled these things out, and of course we were able to, each day we'd stretch the aerials out a further distance, and carry out another set of measurements while this maximum was on. And
mm-hmm.
you know, however far we stretched them, we still got the max and min, showing that we were, you know, pushing the size of the source down, down, down.
Right, right.
And I'm afraid that quantitative description is about as far as I can take that one.
Well, let me ask, when you were doing these things, were you, first of all, when you started, did you know about Jansky and Reber's measurements and had read those papers?
I was introduced to them by Ryle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is one of the points which was taken up in the previous interview, and I'm afraid I simply do not know at exactly what stage Jansky and Reber's stuff came into our ken. I see that before I was under the impression that Hayes' stuff came to our notice first.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't say at what stage.
Yeah.
Well.
Okay. Well, that's the proper answer if that's the correct thing to say, right? Once the war had ended, you presumably became aware of the group at Jodrell Bank and the Australians working on these kind of problems also. Did you not?
Yes, indeed. Yes, Canberra Brown and Kerr in Australia were interested. I think they had Canberra Brown in Australia.
Well, no, he was at Jodrell Bank, but.
Oh well, that shows what's happened to my memory.
But somewhat later, he wasn't at Jodrell Bank right at the very beginning, though.
Well, now, what were the names of
the
people?
That's right. That's right.
Well, Ryle, you see, did all the thinking and reading and all that kind of thing. You must appreciate that my main contribution was getting things done around the place.
I see.
Wiring up circuits in the lab and just getting things done. And I really was given undue credit by Ryle for the thought end of things. See, I was an engineer, not a physicist.
Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, you were the one that built the equipment and
I did what I was told. I Ryle was also incredibly good at designing the equipment. I did a fair amount of actually doing it with my hands.
And it sounds like you took part equally in the observations also.
I was involved in these measurements, observations.
But now, what you're saying, though, is that for the actual reduction of the observations and the analysis of them in an astrophysical context, that Ryle did most of that.
He did most of that, yes, that's quite true.
Okay. Let me ask a couple questions. First of all, what was the source of the land? I mean, was it just a coincidence that this land was available right in back of Ryle's house?
Well, you see, the university owns most of the land out in the westerly direction.
Right.
From Drayton Road, from the football ground onwards, I think, to the rifle range.
That's right. That's right. So you just had to get permission to use it for your purposes, then? Mm-hmm. Right. But it was more or less a coincidence that that Ryle lived there.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Well, I mean, his father was the Regius Professor of Medicine before the war, and that was his house.
Oh, I see. It was actually his father's house also.
That's right. And during the war, it was used by the army, or by the services. It was commandeered to be used by the services for exactly what purpose, I don't know.
Hmm.
And then after the war, it was released by the services, and the Ryle family took it back, converted into flats, to my great good fortune, because it enabled me to get married, and divided up amongst Graham Smith, and we shared the top flat, and Ryle, and Booker, Henry Booker, the mathematician.
Oh, yes.
He had another downstairs flat, and Ryle and the biologist shared the other flat on the ground.
I see. Well, I didn't realize that. And now he still lives there, but presumably it's been converted back. Well, he still lives in that house. But presumably it's been converted from flats back to one big house again. Yeah. That's interesting. Now, a second question is, did you use the Michelson interferometer, the two-element interferometer, right from the very beginning, or did you make some measurements with just a single aerial?
I think we made very few measurements. The interferometer told you so much more information. I mean, you can get all the single aerial information as well out of that, but you get the source size.
Right, right.
So that we very, very early had pairs of aerial units.
Mm-hmm. And are you saying also that the idea of the Michelson interferometer was primarily due to Ryle?
Well, I don't know whether it had been used previously, but certainly he introduced it at Cambridge. Whether Ratcliffe had any hand in it is something I said. I just don't know.
Yeah. As far as I know, it was not used anywhere else in any other groups either.
Well, I mean, the Cambridge people have always prided themselves in great economy of equipment.
Right. This was a good example of that, indeed. Well, in terms of looking at the sun, before we get to the science of it, let me ask you about the, like I say, what is known as the Ryle Vonberg type receiver, even to this day.
What is that?
Well, that's the receiver where you have the balancing, where you're switching against a variable load, and thereby keeping a balanced receiver all the time. Now, that terminology is still standard in radio astronomy. I don't know if you realize that or not.
No, I've never heard of it.
Oh, it
tells you much more about Ryle than about the receiver.
That's interesting. But in any case, you say that Ryle had worked with noise diodes during the war, and so that was all quite familiar to him. And
well, I would think he had, because he was... He was on countermeasures.
Mm-hmm.
I'm rather guessing now, but I would have thought that noise generators would feature in his countermeasures work.
That's right.
I guess that's a partly where he was familiar with them.
Right. Well, I can ask him directly. I'm going to be talking to him in a week or two. I did talk to him many years ago, but I've forgotten whether I asked him that question or not. Was this receiver basically pretty straightforward to build once you had this basic idea, or can you remember particular problems in putting it together?
One of the things was, of course, you had to control the filament of the diode. You had to have a power control, and these were done by valves called thyrotrons.
Mm-hmm.
And these thyrotrons were pretty difficult things to manage, I found, because I got landed with building this Thyrotron control system. And they seemed to me to vary a good deal in their performance. And I remember I had a lot of difficulty getting this Thyrotron, bank of Thyrotrons, under control. Of course, it was a very, very different approach from what we use nowadays. But these were a means of varying, or of producing a high power signal relatively simply, a high power control signal from a low input signal.
I see. Of servo control that in terms of oscillations and so forth that results you were getting. You've already told me about observing the tractors there at once, but do you have any other recollections about the actual observations that you made and some of the interesting discoveries?
Is coming from a source which is a
Right. Right. This is an argument which is used throughout astronomy even today. Context do you remember with the traditional astronomers while you were still there? To discuss the nature of what's going on in the sun, or to try to get simultaneous observations going, or? Excuse me, is our connection getting weak, or are you just talking?
I know what I'm doing. I'm holding the receiver at a different angle. Is that better?
Not too much difference. Than the sun. That's right. If you found periodicity of a certain amount, it might give you a clue as to the latitude of the source, you mean?
Mm-hmm. And I know that having worked out all sorts of lovely ideas on this basis. He then got it over to a mathematician who pronounced there was no correlation at all.
Right.
Well,
this may also have been comparing the two different frequencies. You had 80 megahertz and 175 megahertz. And there was a study of the correlation of the two frequencies.
Yeah. Well, I'm a bit hazy on that one.
Right. Now, were you still there when the first discrete sources were picked up?
Well, I think I may have been. That's what I really mean. We were getting these little ripples. Now, where was it?
Now, in that case, Hay was, I'm quite sure, the first to show the presence of a discrete concentration in the constellation of Cygnus. And if you can remember anything about trying to follow that up, that would be interesting. Because
all I can remember is seeing him slow the recording came off his paper, and his slow hump that he got as the Milky Way passed.
Right.
And then, here and there, you see a series of little ripples supersonic, which made it think that he's got some discrete source there.
Right, right. That's correct, yeah. Well, in fact, that was Hayes' reasoning for finding a small source, even though he didn't have an interferometer, the fact that it changed in intensity so much. Do you remember at the time when you saw these changes in intensity what you thought they might be due to? Yes. Sweden.
And this was really quite beyond me. I found that I always have found gas charges. A bit of a close book. I interested in an area of thought which I have not never really pursued. So I really take too much part in the detailed discussions about the nature of these things, except, as I say, Ryle is, I remember that the temperatures we were getting were absolutely, I was going to say astronomical, but that's against it.
Well, they were 10 to the 9th or 10 to the 10th kelvins, yeah. It's really just a parameter for intensity, of course.
Yes.
What about the polarization experiments? You haven't mentioned those yet. Cross dipoles and... Was it Ryle's idea basically to use these cross dipoles and check for circular polarization and so on?
I do remember his
Alva's results were that you got, in some cases, almost 100% circular polarization. Right. Let me just ask, was Alphane a visitor at Cambridge at that time? You told me about Ratcliffe's role and his ideas at the beginning of your stay, but towards the end of your stay, some 2 years later, was Ratcliffe's role changing? And the other two people that were arrived before you left, namely Stenier and Machen, can you tell me a little bit about the roles they played in the group? Okay, no, I didn't realize that he was there while you were still there. Well, can you tell me about his role in the group while you were there? Yes, and carrying down the routines of Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's just the kind of information I'd like to have, except are there any other things that you'd like to comment on that I haven't asked about? The transcript from the from the Mocha interview. Yes, I do have that. Well, don't worry about that. But excuse me, now, I'm having trouble understanding.
One of the problems when you're working alongside someone who has quite such a brilliant contribution is that one tends to get a little bit lacking in one's own confidence because, you know, if you don't make any notable contributions at all, it gets a bit depressing.
Yeah. It just wasn't satisfying. I see. Right, so you got off into medical research then?
Yeah.
Right.
But I wouldn't have missed the experience there because it was incredibly valuable in teaching one to have a very disciplined mental approach to the trials approach, absolutely uncompromising and so on. And I'm sure you have heard of some.
Oh, Hoyle.
Well,
now you bring him up because of just the fact that Ryle would not compromise with someone that opposed his views.
Well,